Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Politics Done Right. I'm Egberto Willis, your host. I hope to have a wonderful show today. I saw from some of the comments that I had on the part of the post on what I'm going to talk about at the Coffee Party site, one particular comment that I want to address. But before I get there, let's talk about what the show is going to be. First of all, it was a great week. We had a whole lot done here in Texas. We really are working to mobilize people to ensure that they do what's necessary to go out there and vote. And this week we had great coverage of women's movement here with regards to ensuring that women's jobs, not necessarily the same jobs, because there has been a misrepresentation as far as whether there's really equal payout here. There is really equal pay to some extent in certain areas for women with jobs that are of the same task as men. But as you can see here in Texas, in our particular attorney general's office, women for the same job gets paid less. So that is still a factor within this specific issue. So we had some programs on Tuesday where we actually try to raise awareness of the equal pay issue here in Texas and throughout the country. Anyhow, today's program will be about, what is it going to be about? Today is going to be about specifically the piece that I wrote on whether or not it is a fact that the economy does better under a particular presidency or not. It's a very, very touchy subject. And the reason it is touchy, it is that many people tend to believe that it is not necessarily, you cannot necessarily go ahead and say one particular party has some monopoly on economy being good or not. The reality is the research shows otherwise. Now, why does it show otherwise? No one really knows. Or we thought no one really knew. But what we know now is that there is research. So anyhow, here it goes. A few weeks ago, Chuck Todd interviewed a Princeton economist who did some research on economic performance based on the president in office. Something many knew empirically became obvious. Specifically, the economy does substantially better under Democratic presidents and under Republican presidents, irrespective of which party holds Congress. When I watched the interview, I was perplexed in as much as the empirical evidence was irrefutable. Both Chuck Todd and the Princeton economists attempted to waver in their conclusions.
Just had a severe crash on my computer, so therefore I had to go with my second source. This computer has been misbehaving, so what I need to do is bring up the issue that I was talking about before. Anyway, what I was very concerned about the entire issue with regards to how the Chuck Todd interview went was that the professor was very apprehensive when he attempted to show the results. In other words, he went on Chuck Todd's program and he said, well, yes, the research does show that, in fact, under Democratic presidencies, the economy does 1.8% in GDP better, and that is a lot, folks. That is more than 30-something percent better. But when it was time to actually explain the reason why it did better, what occurred is that he said there's a probability that it is luck. Now, when I went ahead and decided to speak to listen to the interview at the end and find out exactly what this guy was talking about, it became pretty evident rather quickly that he did feel some duress in coming out with those conclusions. Because when he was further asked by Chuck Todd near the end of the interview, and for those who are looking at the post, you could actually see that at the end of the interview, Chuck Todd asks, how many tries do you have to have? In other words, he did the experiment with the last 12 presidents. But then some other people have done the experiment that went right back into, I think it was 1845. And believe it or not, the results still came out the same. And I put a link to the report on the internet as well. On the blog post that I did, there's also a link to the report that everyone that's listening may actually want to take a look at. But now that I'm bringing my pad up, I can actually read the blog post that was posted to be read today. And it goes as follows. And it's coming up at this point in time. Let's see. MSNBC Chuck Todd interviewed Princeton economist Alan Espinder to his show, The Daily Rundown, a few weeks ago. They discussed a striking paper that he co-wrote with Princeton economist Professor Mark Watson. The title of the paper is Presidents and the Economy, a Forensic Investigation. The paper is a very well-researched paper that analyzed the performance of the country's economy under different presidents. The paper came to a striking conclusion. The economy does substantially better under Democratic presidents than Republican presidents, like I mentioned before. This occurs irrespective of who controls Congress. Many already knew this. What these Princeton economists did was to quantify the results. They also attempted to play with different degrees of freedom within the data set to find out why Democratic presidents did so much better. Following are some of the excerpts from the paper. The paper begins in section one by documenting this stunning fact. The fact is not stylized. The superiority of economic performance under Democrats rather than Republicans is nearly ubiquitous. It holds almost regardless of how you define success. By many measures, the performance gap is startlingly large, so in fact that it strains credulity given how little influence over the economy most economists, or the Constitution for that matter, assign to the President of the United States. Think about that statement. That is a very prescient statement. In other words, as they're attempting to say in that piece, remember that the presidency does not, this Constitution does not give the president any particular influence over the economy, yet we see those results. Why? They continue later in the paper. while there is substantial variation in growth rates from over 6% for Truman to 1% for Bush, the D to R gap is apparent. That gap remains apparent. Why? Panel B tells the same story in slightly different, in a slightly different way of organizing the data by presidencies rather than by terms, with both the eighth Kennedy-Johnson years and the eighth Nixon-Ford years grouped together. And the data on Truman extended back to 1947. Think about that, till 1947. It is clear at a glance that GDP growth rises when Democrats get elected and falls when Republicans do. There are no exceptions, although the Carter to Reagan transition is almost a dead heat, 3.6 for Carter, 3.5 for Reagan. But for all of those connoisseurs of history, one can remember what occurred under Carter. We can't forget that those were the times of the great oil shock of the 70s. And with any economy that works in oil, we understand that that is a reality. Going further, the NBER recession data gives an even more lopsided view of the D to R difference. Over the 256 quarters, and this is an important statement here, folks, over the 256 quarters in these 16 terms of presidency, that is, Republicans occupied the White House for 144 quarters. They occupied the White House for 144 quarters. Democrats for only 112 quarters. But of the 49 quarters classified by the NBER as in recession, only eight of them were under Democrats versus 41 under Republicans. Why am I saying this? Is this a Republican-Democrat issue? No, it's not. It's a scientific issue that needs exploration. Why does this need exploration? Because we have to find the tie-ins between the ideology and the economy. And if that becomes probative, it is essential we know why, and it is essential that Americans know why. It's not a partisan issue. It's a fact-based issue. Thus, the U.S. economy was in recession for 1.1 quarters on average during each Democratic term, but for 4.6 quarters during each Republican term. Partisan differences well beyond the standard indicators of real growth and unemployment. For example, panel D in table 2 shows that stock market returns for firms in the S&P 500 are 5.4% pointage when Democrats occupy the White House and when Republicans best. But given the extreme volatility of stock prices, even differences that large are statistically significant at only the 17% level. The corporate profit share of gross domestic income was also higher under Democrats by 5.6 versus 4.7%. Though business votes Republican, it prospers under Democrats. This is a professor speaking there. This is not a partisan. This is a nonpartisan type paper. The only notable exception to the rule that Democrats outperform Republicans seem to be the inflation, where the economy fares about equally well under presidents of either party. For example, the final panel table 2 shows that the average inflation rate was slightly lower under Democratic presidents, 2.9% versus 3.32%, using the PCE deflator, 2.88 versus 3.44, using the, and, you know, these items continue on and on and on. However, I want to kind of end with what I thought about the paper in general. Please go to the blog. I don't want to spend all the time just reading the issue, but specifically, this is my conclusion. It seems these professors went out of their way to avoid knocking the political boat. They had the data that showed Democratic presidents' economists outperformed Republican economists by a substantial margin. They removed the probability that this success was an offshoot from a previous administration. No matter how they change the degrees of freedom on their models, Democratic presidents come out ahead. Yet they are willing to simply ascribe the reality to mostly good luck. There are intrinsic values they did not explore. How does the rest of the world and the country relate to the character of the president? How does the president's perceived values promote a particular behavior? Those items aren't luck. There are likely many more, as the professors indicate, that need to be explored. One must wonder if they simply wanted to ensure that their study would not be deemed as partisan given the corrosively partisan environment. The data on the economy is what it is. Surprising that this paper did not receive massive publicity. Had the results of this research shown a Republican advantage on the economy, you can rest assured that the corporatocracy, every news station and PAC's PACs would be covering it and advertising it at nauseam. So, folks, what do you think? What do you think or the paper means? Now, at this point in time, I'm still having some issues with these computer systems. For some particular reason, we are unable to see the board. So, if any of my other coffee party board runners are out there, I'd like you to see who needs to get the floor at this time until I am able to pull that up. But what do you think? How is this possible? How comes many have not heard about this? Why? What's the case? What do you think? Now, let's see if I can actually get somebody pulled up here on the board. Bear with me, folks. I'm trying to get the board working, but I am having some issues with it simply not giving us the opportunity to let people in. So I'm going to try something else here as we speak. Maybe another browser, and see if that will somehow mitigate the problem. Anyhow, after reading this issue, I think I placed this at the end of the blog. What I did tell folks is that on my Politics Done Right show on KPFT on Monday, we're not going to be specifically discussing this particular paper, but what we are going to be doing, discussing this paper discussing the issues within this paper in an interesting manner. My contention is that most of the times the media is responsible for dictating the agenda from the not only the plutocracy's point of view, but from the puppet master's point of view. And until that changes, nothing changes. So what we are going to do on that day is we're going to be bringing in several bloggers, several web news makers, so that they can decide or so that they can tell why it's going to be necessary or why it is necessary that we start crowdsourcing news. It is necessary that we start crowdsourcing news because absent that, we get these types of issues. People don't get a chance to make their vote on qualified issues. People don't get a chance to say, I am going to vote this way based on all the information that I have. I am going to vote based on real information. it is ironic that this professor, and I would urge you to take a look at the video snippet that I provide, or that I provided for the show. I mean, not for this particular show, but for the blog post on which presidencies actually do better by the economy. And the reason I think that is important is because what it shows that things we believe should be covered, things that one would think would be covered, don't get the coverage that should be gotten. And we don't exactly know why. We don't know why, or do we? The plutocracy. The plutocracy in action. That is the reason why we must again ask, is should we be making news as, or the what we call today the traditional news media, and by the way, that is what is being covered on my Daily Coast article this week, which is, should we be making the traditional news media irrelevant? My contention is, yes, we should be making the news media going forward irrelevant. Absent that, the continued erosion of the middle class will continue. Absent that, what is left? Now, folks, I'm going to try to get in through another method to the system, so give me 30 seconds. Now, I think we are finally back. This has been a terrible entry into a blog talk crash. Now, I think I have John. John, is that you?
Yes, it is. Good afternoon, Egberto.
Good afternoon, my friend. Tell me what you think about what we've been discussing thus far.
Well, first of all, I want to know who the four bloggers are going to be on Monday night on your KPFT show.
Okay, the four bloggers are going to be Stace Medellin from doscentavos.net. We're going to have Catherine from burntorangereport.com, which is the, I think you know who they are.
Absolutely.
And then we're going to have Charles Kuffner from onthecuff.com. And then the other blogger is going to be Tiffany Willis from liberalamerica.org. So we
Sounds
have
excellent.
Whole, yeah, so we're going to have quite a bit of bloggers that are actually writing a whole lot of good stuff. And, you know, we hope that, you know, one of the ideas behind that show is going to be to try to attempt to encourage the crowdsourcing of the news. In other words, when I read a piece like the piece that I just read from the Princeton Economist, and we see all these other pieces that don't get any coverage but that are actually very substantive, you actually worry about who's really controlling the media, who's really controlling all these particular issues that have to be covered that don't get covered. Why do we make the kinds of decisions that we make based on the type of information that we have? It is actually a very poor state. So, I mean, one of the things that going forward with this show and the KPFT show specifically is going to be to encourage, you know, a lot of people look at, you know, let's say bloggers like those that work at the Huffington Post or those that work at Burnt Orange or these other places as bloggers or something, let's say, you know, out of the ordinary that these people are picking up news. I am going a bit further than that. I'm trying to tell folks that everybody should be empowered because in their particular area, every little area that you're in, there's news happening. And using platforms like Burnt Orange or Daily Coast or all these other places where bloggers get a chance to actually put stuff out there that many people are going to see, it is eventually going to be a lot more important than Chuck Todd being the arbiter of the news that people should get, or any particular organization, whether that even be Coffee Party, would be the arbiter of any news that one would get. My contention is we definitely do not want that. I am strongly moving, or not moving, I've already moved there, but I'm hoping to have folks move to that state where they realize that news is not to be simply fed to them, but that they are not only the news, or they are not only the ones who should be dictating what is considered news. I mean, I had a discussion a few days ago with a person that said, you know, we're talking about the same Ukraine issue, and my question to them was simple: taking no position, I'm asking them, why is it that Americans now are so engulfed, let's say, in the Ukraine issue? And they said, well, you know, because Russia is going on and so forth. I said, yeah, bad thing, all of that is true. But there was a lot occurring in Ukraine before this blow-up. This blow-up didn't happen on a dime. This blow-up, you know, was foreseen. In fact, if we had followed news a few weeks before, we would have seen all these issues. But nobody covered it. The same applied to healthcare. The same applied with all these different issues. These things don't happen on a dime, but they're never covered. So whenever it's covered as it's an emergency. People get passionate. People start to react passionately. And what is the worst thing you can do, John, is to react passionately to, you know, to something that has something that is very important, because you don't want passion. You want fact-based information guiding your behavior. Now, today, I'm going to let you see a piece of it. Today, there's something that got to me, and that is after I posted this particular issue on the Coffee Party page, one of the people who read the article, most of the article people were very positive about the article, but one particular person called me a partisan hack. And I wanted to explore that. You know, I really wanted to explore being a partisan hack. Am I really a partisan? Yes. Am I a hack? Well, let's debate that. But not only that, do I want to work in a harmonious way with other people, in a harmonious way with other parties? Absolutely so. I do not believe any one party has all the answers. However, in the attempt to not seem partisan, should we withhold truths from Americans? And that's where I'd like you to comment.
Well, of course we shouldn't withhold truth. I do want to comment on the actual Blinder Watson paper, though, because I do
yes.
feel the article is flawed. And
okay.
one of the reasons I think it is flawed is it the fact that it doesn't consider who controls Congress, and it also doesn't consider, I mean, it does to some degree within the 57 pages, and I wasn't able to read all of the 57 pages.
Let me stop you for 1 second there, 1 minute, because that when I you remember, I don't know if you read my post where I said,
yeah.
I read this a few weeks ago, and I didn't want to comment about it because it's a long article, and I actually wanted to read the article before I commented, because it could be a very partisan article, and I didn't want to go there. So I decided to read the article. And let me just make one correction. They did change the degrees of freedom of the article and found that that the data applies irrespective of whether it's a Republican Congress, a Democratic Congress, or a split Congress. They did isolate for those three scenarios in their analysis. And you can look at one of the charts below that actually shows it as well. All these different isolations occurred. So, I mean, if you also look at some parts of the conclusion, they specifically wanted to do all those things because it seemed like these guys were actually going out of their way to make sure that no one could actually state somehow this paper was of a partisan nature. But go ahead and continue, my friend.
Well, I mean, I guess I just haven't gotten to that part yet because I haven't
right.
seen that. But,
yeah.
I mean, one
it's
thing that
there.
Has to be One thing that has to be considered, though, is between 1955 and 1981, the Democrats held both the House and the Senate for all those years. And so, you know, if you look at the three Republican presidents who held office during that time, they were Eisenhower, Nixon, and Ford. What happened during that time period is there was much more of a consensus about economic policy. In fact, Nixon said it best when he said, "We're all Keynesians now." He said that in the 70s.
Yes,
and
I
so, so there really wasn't this huge gap that happened starting. I mean, it basically started with the oil shocks, and I know it does talk a little bit about the oil shocks in there. But, I mean, the oil shocks made everybody reconsider the economy, especially conservatives, especially it kind of gave the plutocrats a little bit of a gap to say, you know, this isn't working with all this stagflation and the economy that's been so great for so many years and has helped the middle class for so many years is now kind of going downhill. Now, that was an exaggeration in itself, because it really wasn't that bad. You know, if you look at income inequality since Reagan took over, you know, the Carter years really weren't as bad as they were perceived at the time, if you look at history.
And the article states that, yeah. The article actually states that, and this was, now that part I didn't know, and that was that even under the Carter economy, we had average growth that was larger than Reagan's. Think about that.
Another thing about what the supply side or trickle down era is, it's really hard if you're just looking at growth. That can be deceiving, because you know when growth happens in an economy that has high income inequality, that growth is benefiting the wealthy. It's not benefiting the middle class. It's not benefiting, you know, the working poor. It's benefiting the wealthy. And so I don't know if that's really the best way of measuring. And also, if you a lot of people measure the stock markets, and this is also what a lot of people have said through the years, that the stock market, they're amazed that Republicans support. The business community supports Republicans because the stock market always does better under Democrats.
Exactly.
And so this is another point it's easy to skew the differentials. I would have liked to have seen, you know, well, let's look at the middle class and let's look at how the middle class has done during these presidencies. And I will look some more as far as who actually held Congress. I haven't seen it yet there, but I think that is underrepresentative from what I've seen.
Let me say one thing: the intent of the paper was not. I mean, what you're asking for is actually the best measure. There's no doubt about that. In other words, the question should be: where does the middle, when and under whom, or if it makes a difference, does the middle class prosper? You're absolutely correct about that. The issue of this paper, though, was a forensic on specifically the growth of the economy. You know, because here's the deal: you can have you're correct when you state that a growing economy doesn't necessarily mean a growing middle class, which we've seen in the last 30 years. The middle class has been stagnant, and all the productivity increase went to a group of people, right? But what we can state, if that growth, you know, we know that the growth is there. We know that the policies for growth is there. The question is, how is that distributed? And that would be my next issue, and I think you hit it on the nail, and that is, why is it that the reality is that, and we have to separate 1980 forward from the Depression to 1980. There's a very important thing that we have to distinguish there, because that is when we got supply side on steroids. We got supply side in 80. We got supply side on steroids in 2000, right? 2000 was the last set of steroids. So we have to look at those performances and as far as why it is then that the middle class suffered under those. Now, I did do some number crunching when I wrote my book back in 2010 and showed that in as much as income inequality over the last 30 years have, you know, kept the country stagnant, it is true that under Clinton, the growing economy did lift these boats. There was one big problem, however, and that is what role debt of the middle class played in that growth. So that was still the major issue. In other words, the middle class did substantially better in those 6 years. I think it was a 6 year window for Clinton when I did my thing. I think that's what I found, a 6 year window when they did incredibly well. But then it all fell apart after 2000 came about. So I mean, but it is something that I think should be explored after. I think what we have to do first is accept the reality of the tenet, right? If the tenet is, if you have a 1.6 difference in GDP, John, is huge. You know, people don't look at it. When people see a 1.6%, a 1.8% differential in GDP, they're like, that's only 1 point. That is actually quite huge. And they're in a market system, as opposed to trying to attempt to make, you know, to appease anybody, one should try to figure out exactly what are the, not necessarily only policies, but why is that the case? The big problem I had with the paper is the end is the conclusion of the paper. The conclusion of the paper said, we don't know exactly why that is the case, but we think it just may be luck. After you've given a whole list of data, come out and you say it's luck. But then if you listen to the interview that he gives on MSNBC, he says when they did their analysis, they figured out that when you look at a stat like that, it's only a 1% probability that it's by chance. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, I follow exactly what you're saying. I obviously, you know, feel that, you know, Keynesian economics, you know, is really what we should still be striving for. And, you know, Europe is moving away from that. And to some degree, even the Democratic Party, you know, is not, you know, pushing this enough. I think the progressives are. But, I mean, I just wanted to go back to, you know, when Reagan took office in 1981, the highest tax rate was 70%. The next year he dropped it to 50%. In 1987 it was dropped to 38.5%. By 1988, his last year in office, it was dropped to 28%. So it went from 70% when he took office to 28%. And, you know, anybody who – you know, has studied any kind of economics will realize that there will be mass inequality, that the upper class are going to be, you know, there will be robber barons during this era. You cannot sustain an economy with the top tax rate at 28%. Now, Paul Ryan wants to put the top tax rate at 25%. And, you know, and another point I want to talk about a little bit is Clinton. And one thing, you know, we talked a little bit about last year about how the growth during the Clinton years was better than any other president post-World War II. The second was Reagan. And one thing that Clinton had to contend with is, you know, he only had 2 years. Well, he had both the House and the Senate, his first 2 years,
right.
In the 1994 election and all the rest of his presidency, the next 6 years, he had Republicans in the House and majorities in the House and in the Senate.
Right.
And so, I mean, he really wasn't able to push his agenda. I mean, you know, I'm really glad that he got that tax rate up to 39.6%. But, I mean, in his first thing in office, But you know, it really, he really wasn't able to push his agenda. This was a very much a compromise with the Republicans, and a lot of economic you know, professors will say that one of the things that was driving that the most was the tech boom and the advent of the internet, and I certainly agree with that. So I mean, you can't just look specifically at, you know, policies. There are also outside economic forces that you know, included in all the different eras of technology, whether you're talking about the advent of the steam engine or the Intercontinental Railroad, all of
these.
Yeah,
I think though what they're trying to say though, John, I really need to say this part. I think what they're trying to say is, first of all, what you're saying is absolutely correct, right? Yes, it's true that Clinton, for the next 6 years, he had to contend with a lot of pushback and compromise, of course. But the major accomplishment was done in his first 2 years. We can say the same thing with President Obama, right? President Obama front-loaded his first 2 years when he had full democratic control of the administration and the Congress. That's where all the major pieces of legislation that are going to be substantive got passed during that time. And from then on, it's a fight. And that fight is Republicans stopping him from doing his thing, and the president stopping Republicans from doing their thing. So in effect, two of his first years, and it's where he was in full control. And if you take a look at this paper again, what this paper shows is most of the benefits were achieved in the first 2 years of the president that we're speaking about, whether Republican or Democrat, in that administration. Most of the effects was during the first 2 years of this administration. Now, when it comes to compromise, you're correct, but this paper was written from an empirical standpoint, right? In other words, it started from an empirical standpoint, something that people have seen. Why is it that we have 4.x% growth on the Democrats and 2.x% on the Republicans? That's a fact. Now we go ahead and we break it down to each administration. Why is it that each Democratic administration has a higher growth rate than all Republican administrations? You ask yourself that question. Now, these are first observations. Now, what this paper was attempting to do after looking at the observation, as the title implies, it was doing a forensic analysis. Okay, now that we know those particular facts, why is it that irrespective of what you've just said, meaning whether it's a compromise between administrations because of who controls Congress or not, that this pattern holds steadfast? What is it that's making this pattern hold steadfast? Now, they were unable to come to a conclusion at the end of the paper. So what they said is they know that they believe, based on their analysis, oil shocks, productivity increases, and when you spoke about the internet, that would be talking about productivity increases. I think they call it PPE, and also other international. It was oil shock, productivity increase, and expectation. Those were three things that they said. We could attribute those three things to which had an impact on this growth as maybe luck. But then, what explains the other 40%? Okay, what explains the other 40%? And that's what the article says. But then what was blatant when it came out on when Chuck Todd tried to put it on TV is that the way he promoted it is like, well, this is what has happened over all these years, and it, according to the professor, it could just be luck. When if you read the paper, you know, you may not exactly know all the specific reasons why that is the case, but just based on it being as consistent as it is, you cannot put it. And even at the end, the professor says as much. And, you know, I think what I was really, one of the reasons that I really wanted to bring this particular case up is I wanted us to get away from, and when I say us, I'm talking about the population in general, as continuously looking at a particular group of people as those who have the information those who have all the answers or those who are going to tell the story. Because this is a piece that I think came out in November of last year. Chuck Todd just put it on a few weeks ago. Okay, and I don't know how comes he put it on. It was just out of the blue that he put it on. I think it came out when the GDP numbers came out. And I sat down there watching it in the morning on my bike, and I'm thinking, why is he displaying this piece of information now? And then I wanted to write about it, but I didn't, it's a touchy situation because it seems rather partisan. So I said, you know what, I'll wait till I have some time to read the entire document. When you read the entire document, it is actually, when you read all the different analysis that he does, and when they try to go through the different degrees of freedom, isolating a particular set of data to see if it makes a difference based on some other feature. And I don't think it's I think their conclusion seemed to be passive. In other words, I think their conclusion, they're attempting to not rock the boat, but I don't think that's what their paper said at all. If you read their paper and their conclusion doesn't necessarily agree. So when you get a chance to read it, it would be nice if you kind of blog a little something or you put something on the sheet or the page for the show, because I think it would be quite informative if we actually got that done. Let me run and get Jack in here, and then I'll come back to you, John. Jack. What say you?
Okay, this is Jack Golding.
Yes.
And you hear me?
Yes, I can, sir.
Okay. We mentioned two things. First of all, you know, we can get the debt down to nothing, and we can get the military. Well, one thing is to cut the military. Anything for the Ryan budget is going to be exactly the opposite of what I think. First of all, if the military can be cut, and secondly, we can cut things like this. What happened in Iraq?
Jack, I want to break into and say something, because I think it's important, because a lot of us, whether you're liberal, conservative, or whatever, we're always quick to say, a conservative may say, let's cut some social programs. A liberal may say, let's cut the military, let's cut here and there, all right? I think what is important for us to know as a people, and I think we have to be honest with the American population, is that no matter where the cuts come, right, it's going to affect the economy. Let me talk about cutting the military and why I am not.
Well, let me say this, and then ignore the big things like the Koch brothers on both sides. You got the Democrats, the Republicans too. They're interested, influence some big money in politics. And you get a cut. You get the booming economy. You get all the manufacturing up and the infrastructure problems settled. You get
that
employment, and you get the employment for all. And you get a cut in with the minimum wage and all that stuff. You got to
But Jack, here's what I want to say. You're correct, but there's something I need to get in here to folks, because right now everybody talks about who and what we should cut. Right, no matter what it is that we cut, whether it is social programs or the military, it will have adverse effects on people. In other words, let's say we cut the military in Virginia where they're building ships, right? It means that there are a lot of laid-off workers out there.
Somebody's ox is going to be gored. That's the truth.
Right.
You have to be realistic about it.
Yes,
and I
exactly.
Think
so what we have to
more
what
people
we have
with,
to do,
with the way the Ryan
yes, sir.
To carry out.
Let me finish this, though, Jack. Let me finish the statement. It's important, because I think what we have to do is we have to be honest about it. We can't just rush and cut defense dramatically and say we're going to balance the budget that way, because what's going to happen is you're going to have a lot of people that are laid off, and those people are then going to be going for government services, which again is opposite to what the intent was. We have to find a way that as we're closing down one industry, we're populating them with something else. In other words, and so I am not for doing drastic action per se, but I am, the drastic action I want is our infrastructure. You are correct when you say our infrastructure is in distress, and we could move immediately from the defense people that's working in the defense to moving those people into working on infrastructure.
And paying the veterans off, too. Now, helping the veterans.
Yes, and there are two banks for the
bus. A lot of money can go to that, getting that backlog off of there. Although they say they got the backlog was down about 44% from what I heard.
Okay, Jay, let me get John back in here. John, what do you think about that?
Well, I think, you know, last week you and Jack talked about the deficit, and I really didn't have time to talk too much about it. But I guess I just have a little bit of a fundamental disagreement. I was a little bit surprised that you were talking about the deficit under Reagan, and this kind of goes back to your book also when you were talking about how Reagan essentially had a stimulus because of the increase in military spending.
Right.
And that was his stimulus, and I think that you know, I think that if his stimulus would have been, you know, let's say putting more money in infrastructure, putting more money in education, I think that there's nothing wrong with, you know, putting a lot of money in there, and the debt was really incredibly low at that time, and so yes, he did increase it by 300%. But this is another thing that we've talked about. We haven't talked about it recently, but we talked about it, you know, 6 months ago, 9 months ago, quite a bit. And that is basically that this whole debt obsession is just completely overblown, and that we should be talking about stimulus instead of reducing the debt. And that's been one of the problems with Obama, is that he bought into this debt fetishization, and that's really hurt his presidency. I mean,
no,
yeah,
it is
true.
Yeah, I think you're right, John. I don't know that I don't know that I am debt obsessed. I think maybe in the book when I mentioned about Reagan's debt, I think I was more doing it as a counter critique. Not to say that debt is bad. And the other thing about Reagan's debt is his debt went into building up a military-industrial complex as opposed to building up people, as opposed to building up education, as opposed to building up these other issues. So, I mean, we can borrow. As far as I'm concerned, we should be borrowing money at near 0% to really fix the infrastructure, and that'll probably pay for itself in the circulation of money that occurs. So, no, I really don't think that I am debt-obsessed. I think most of the times you'll hear me use debt, and if I don't, you know, you can point that out to me. But it is mostly as far as a critique when one party tries to slam the other party for somehow blowing up the debt more than the other.
Right. No, I agree with what you're saying. I mean, this isn't something you don't talk about very often, but I'm just saying on that particular, you know, last week you did talk about that, and you were talking. I mean, what you were saying was actually true when you were talking about how the debt has decreased, you know, year to year, but it's actually increased, you know. So, I mean, just because it's gone down from $1 trillion to, let's say, $550 billion, I mean, it still adds. Right, it's still when we borrow money, that we still have to pay interest on that money, as taxpayers, and that goes towards the economy. And so, I mean, that is a correct observation. But I think you agree with me. I just think you, for whatever reason, you know, you kind of went off on that tangent, and it was a little bit surprising.
Yeah, I think now that you're saying that, I probably wasn't as clear as I needed to be, because I am definitely not a debt hawk. I am a people's hawk. In fact, if folks know, I think most folks should realize that money is a man-made entity, and I can't. We only have 2 minutes now, so I don't have the time to go into what I wanted to say about money being a man-made entity. But there was one fact all of us need to realize. There's a lot of work to be done. There's a lot of people need education, and the only thing that is holding us back is an economic system that is being that is holding chains on us from being able to move forward. But with that, John, give me a little closing argument because we got to get out of here, and we're going to have a good show on Monday.
Yeah, just looking forward to the show on Monday with KPFT, and you know, enjoyed the show. There are two articles, real quick, that I think that people that came out this week. One of them, I think, it really applies to the situation, and that's the lead article from Ezra Klein. And I don't agree with the title, but it's called "Politics is How Politics is Making Us Stupid," and it's a very good article, and I definitely would recommend everybody to read it. And the other article is also on the new Vox website. It's by Sarah Cliff, who used to be on the Wonk blog with Ezra Klein, and it talks about single payer and it's happening in Vermont in 2017. It's a very long article. It says, forget Obamacare, Vermont wants to bring single payer to America. And it's a very good, balanced article that talks about the real issues that have to be brought to the attention.
Can you do me a favor, please, and put that on my page, those two articles? I saw the Ezra Klein one. I didn't read it, but please put it on my page so that I can recall it, both of those. Folks, this is Coffee Party Radio. I don't have time to tell you guys what the name of the other shows, but please go to my blog. They're all listed there. Until next week, politics done right. I'm very sorry for the rocky beginning, but we'll try to have things better next week. You guys have a wonderful Saturday. Have a great, great day. Bye-bye.